Havana, Cuba, free territory of the Americas. Radio Free Dixie invites you to listen to the free voice of the South. Stay with us for music, news, and commentary by Robert F. Williams.
In the spirit of 76, in the cause of freedom and justice, let our people take to the streets in fierce numbers, meet violence with violence, and let our battle cry be heard around the world. Freedom, freedom, freedom now, or death.
You are tuned to Radio Free Dixie, the voice of armed self-defense, broadcasting in the year of fire.
We may not have a cent to pay the rent, but we're gonna make it. I know we will.
You are listening to Root Work. My name is Tonda Sizwe, and I am a root worker. We return to our program today, Self-Respect, Self-Defense, and Self-Determination, a conversation with Mabel Williams and Kathleen Cleaver.
So both of you have these kind of very compelling stories about getting started, and I want to hear a little bit more about kind of how that progressed from there. One of the things that Angela brought up was the kissing case, and I think that's a really important thing for people to know about. So I'm wondering, Mabel, if you'd be willing to just say a few words about what that was and what kind of climate that set up in Monroe.
There were two little boys, 8 and 10, playing with some white little girls and boys out in the meadow, and a kissing game ensued. Well, the kids didn't think anything about it. One of the little white girls went home and said, told her mama, "Mama, I was playing with Hanover today and I kissed him." Well, her white mother got all excited, started scrubbing her mouth with soap and water. And when the father came in, she told the father about it. And the father got upset, and he got his shotgun, and he got with some of his neighbors, and they were going to go and find the boys. He was planning to kill them. I don't know how the sheriff got involved in it, but the sheriff, the chief of police, went and arrested those two little boys, took them to court. The judge said he had a separate trial for the white family, brought them in so they didn't have to face the black ones. Had a trial for those boys and sentenced them to indeterminate sentences. They were going to have to go to a juvenile home until they were 21 years old for kissing the little white girl while they were playing. Meanwhile, while they were in jail, happened to be around Halloween, and the police thought it would be funny to put on Klan robes and scare them. And they did that. They had them in the basement of the jail. Those boys had not seen their mothers since they had been arrested. They were there and did not see their parents until the so-called trial. Well, Robert heard about it, and we started a defense committee for the boys. And Robert was very excellent at getting word out. He wrote up some news releases, and we had a crusade at that time, and we sent out news releases, and we were able to get people all over the country concerned about it. And one Dutch paper ran an editorial with a picture saying that these little boys were jailed for a kiss. There was a young white reporter who came to our town, and she wanted to do the story, and so Rob took her to the place where the boys were held, and they slipped in a camera and took pictures of the little boys. Well, we were able finally to get those little boys released after lots and lots and lots of pressure, because when their picture appeared on the front page of this Dutch paper, there was a big outcry. And the United States then put pressure on North Carolina, and North Carolina put pressure on our county. But they accused Robert of being a communist, of course, because only communists, you know, would come forth, not good Southern people, to intervene in a case like that. If you get a chance to read Negroes with Guns, there is an account of that story there and also in Radio Free Dixie.
One of the things that we were talking about the other day that I think both of you talk about so well is kind of the concept of self-defense and what that means. And you were saying, Kathleen, that you were hoping that people could recuperate the history of self-defense in a way. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to talk about this broader sense beyond, you know, while arming yourself is important, you both kind of maintain that throughout, kind of broadening out what people conceive of when they think of self-defense.
Well, I will, but before, I'd like to just make a comment about the book Negroes with Guns, because I saw it when I first came out to the Bay Area in July of 1967 in Eldridge Cleaver's apartment. He had a whole case full of them, and he was handing them out. And anybody that came into the Black Panther Party had to get a copy of Negroes with Guns. They had to read it. We had to discuss it. And this notion of self-defense that was in the book was very effective, because Robert Williams, for those of you who haven't read it, Robert Williams pointed out that if there's a violent Klansman who believe fervently in white supremacy, they will come to take your life. But if you're armed, they have to make a calculation. Are they willing to risk their superior life to take your inferior life? So there was an important role to be armed that, in Robert Williams' discussion, reduced the level of violence. And so in the community that I was accustomed to being in the South, all the Black people had guns. I mean, it was just not even discussed. You had guns. There'd be a call. It would go out. If, in fact, they heard the Klan was going to ride, everybody would be prepared. And then there was no discussion. There was no parades. In fact, I thought it was odd when I came to Oakland. I said, you know, people walk around with guns and displaying them and parading around. It just seemed kind of, well, you wouldn't do it in Alabama. But everybody had the guns. But as far as the concept, in 67, there were huge rebellions. In this country, they tried to call them riots. There was uprisings in Detroit in which the U.S. Army in tanks were shooting, you know, house-to-house sniper fighting in Detroit. There was riots and uprisings and rebellions in Newark that thousands of people were arrested and millions of dollars of property damage. And so we, the revolutionaries, the Black Power revolutionaries, we thought this was the beginning. You know, this was like insurrection, and it was going to move from insurrection to revolution. And our concept of self-defense was not merely we will have weapons so when the terrorists or the police come, we'll be defended. That was definitely a core. But also the notion of violence that was so pervasive. The Black community was subjected to the violence of horrible education, the violence of bad housing, the violence of insults, the violence of the inability to get jobs that are sufficient for your livelihood, being subjected to trials by juries that were against you from the get-go, being sent to prison, not having a fair trial, being sent into the military to fight against people who, on the other side of the world, had done nothing to us. And so these were, in the Black Panther Party, considered forms of violence against which we had to defend ourselves. So this notion of self-defense was broader than weapons, but it did not at all exclude weapons, and that was fundamental. The notion that people had to accept the responsibility of standing up for themselves.
In Monroe, North Carolina, we knew that the power structure in the local town was against us. But we didn't know when we started fighting that the FBI was supporting the power structure, that the federal government was supporting the power structure. We were asking for simple things we thought were simple things, just the right to have a job in a plant that was being supported by tax dollars and government contracts. But they wouldn't give us that, and Robert was one trying to go through channels, asking the federal government to come in and intervene. Look what these people are doing to us, you know. They were oppressing us terribly. But at the same time, not unlike what was happening with them. When the Klan would come out, people would be afraid. That had been our history. People would go in the houses and close the door and pull down the blinds. They had the guns in there, but they still would be afraid of the Klan. Well, Robert said, we should not be afraid of the Klan, because if they're going to invade our communities, we should protect ourselves. Well, he was very much one for obeying the law, and the law said you could carry a gun as long as it wasn't concealed. So he walked around with a Luger on one side, and when we drove our cars around, even during our civil rights movement, we had a gun on the seat of the car. So they were legal. He was trying to stay within the legalities of what the law said. But see, what he did, what he knew but did not accept is that the law wasn't meant for us, but he was going to make it be for us. And he said if he would rather die just 5 minutes standing up like a man than crawling at the feet of his oppressors. Fortunately, he never had to kill anybody. I witnessed 3 attempts on his life while the authorities stood there and watched and pretended that they just didn't see. On one occasion, he asked the chief of police, did you see that? Do you hear those shots? We were picketing at a swimming pool, and people were shooting at our demonstrators. And the police chief said, no, I didn't hear anything, Robert. He said, well, I'm glad to know you're hard of hearing, because when we start shooting, you won't hear that either.
So the actions that you took as part of the NAACP in Monroe, yes, eventually led you all into a sticky situation where Robert was eventually charged with kidnapping charges, yes, right? And you too, Kathleen, ended up having to go into exile. And I'm wondering if the two of you could talk a little bit about the circumstances that led up to your exile from this country.
We were in Monroe, and we had all kinds of demonstrations for... We used the tactical demonstrations of nonviolence, trying to sit down on a lunch stool reserved for white people. And as we would go around to the different drug stores, no less, who had they would sell us the medicine, but we couldn't sit down and have an ice cream cone. So we'd go to the drug stores and so forth. Picketing. Robert was arrested in that incident. We picketed the swimming pool. We asked for one day in the swimming pool if they could not build one in our community. Well, just give us one day. And they said, oh, no, we can't do that. And Rob said, why? They said, we'd have to wash out the pool after you used it. So anyway, that's what spurred us to continue picketing for the right to swim in a tax-supported swimming pool. We had a 10-point program that we presented to the city officials asking for basic human rights, really, and they weren't about to budge because they knew they had the backing of the Klan and the state troopers and the federal government and everybody else. At one time, the Freedom Riders, who were down in Alabama, came in, asked if we would accept them to come in and demonstrate in our hometown to help us. Actually, they wanted to prove that nonviolence worked. And so Robert said, well, you can come in and we will protect you as long as you're in our community. But, you know, I'm not going out there because they know that I am not going to allow anybody to spit in my face or whatever and get away and live. So the Freedom Riders came into our community and supported us, and they had pickets, and we had one white Freedom Rider that came from England, and she was living with in the homes of some of our people and picketing along with us. But the officials were calling for support from the Klan and everybody else. They were determined to crush our movement. So on Robert told them, said, now wait, let's not, I don't think you should demonstrate on Saturday or Sunday, because that's, you know, when all these folks are going to be off work and they're going to be getting their beer and stuff, and this is going to be pretty bad. But they chose to go ahead and demonstrate on Saturday and Sunday. The city officials sprayed insecticide on the picketers while they were going around. James Foreman was there, and he was on the picket line, and when they got ready to leave, Robert had sent the groups of armed men in to bring them out, because thousands of racists were surrounding the picketers, and they had begun to shout at them, to kick, spit on them, and so forth. And the police were on the side of the rioters. We were in our community protecting our community, but waiting for them to come back. And all hell had broken loose. People were really upset about what is happening to the young people who were on the demonstration line. And a white couple came into our community. And though Rob kept them from being killed, they said that they had been kidnapped. And then Rob got a telephone call saying, in 30 minutes, you cause a lot of trouble. In 30 minutes, you're going to be hanging from the courthouse square. So he said, come on, get the children. We have to leave. And we left thinking that we would go to New York, wait a while, and then come on back home, let things cool off. When we got to New York, there was a FBI bulletin, all points, saying Rob was armed and dangerous and should be, and schizophrenic, and should be apprehended. And then at the end it said he's traveling in the company of his family. So we left Monroe thinking we would go back. But once that FBI, he was on the 10 most wanted people list, and his poster was tacked up in post offices all over. Lots of people have those posters now. Couldn't stay. I understand they couldn't stay in the post office because people would steal them for a souvenir.